Well, a warm welcome again to this fourth lecture in our series on risk. Tonight we're talking about risk and government, and of course the risks associated with government were never more evident than this week, with politicians strenuously seeking to avoid blame from one extreme for starting illegitimate wars to the other for fiddling expenses. And our subject tonight is, to use a word that's new to me, the architectonics of blame avoidance. And I'm sure we'll discover what the word means in very shortly. Our speaker is Professor Christopher Hood, who's Gladstone Professor of Government at Oxford. He was educated at York and Glasgow universities, and he's had professorships in Sydney and the London School of Economics before going to Oxford. He's a distinguished authority on the processes of government and public administration, the incentives, the constraints, the game playing that goes on within mighty bureaucracies. And among other aspects, he's written about risk regulation regimes and the management of blame. So clearly he's very appropriate to talk about risk and government. Christopher Hood.
Abstract, which I hope you've seen. My lecture tonight will focus on the risk that matters most in politics and bureaucracy, namely the risk of blame. And I'm going to try over the next 50 minutes to take you through this route here. I want to start with some puzzles, beginning with questions about how political and governmental leaders spend their time. Why did Italy's controversial Prime Minister, Silvio Berlusconi, spent his first day back at work following nearly a month's absence after being injured in an attack in mid-December, working on three judicial reform bills instead of all the other important things that no doubt were piled up on his desk waiting for his attention? Why, according to Howard Kurtz, did the top White House people during Bill Clinton's presidency of the United States spend, quotes, perhaps half their time either talking to the press, plotting press strategy, or reviewing how their latest efforts had played in the press, unquote, when there were so many other weighty matters that these eminences could have given their attention to? Why, asked Professor Christopher Pollitt some years ago at the start of a very detailed study of British machinery of government changes over 20 years, did prime ministers of Britain and their most senior official advisers spend so much of their scarce and valuable time working on the small print of government organisation rather than all the other important matters they could have concerned themselves with? Particularly when such individuals often, indeed invariably, declare that they're more interested in results or what works than in details of process and machinery. When it comes to government and risk, the subject you've asked me to speak on tonight, there are other things to puzzle over as well. Why are responsibilities for dealing with risks so rarely joined up among different organisations, different levels of government, different office holders? Why is it that when we hit often fairly commonplace risk problems, such as elderly people that might be having difficulty in looking after themselves, even potholes appearing in the road, do we so often find ourselves being shunted around different organisations, at best left to ourselves to make the connections, and at worst reaching a dead end after having been ground down by mutual buck passing and helplines that proved to be anything but helpful? Why, too, in spite of decades of much discussed reforms purporting to promote good governance by improving accountability and increasing transparency in the operations of government? Does responsibility for adverse events so often prove to be extraordinarily elusive when, if the vulgar phrase can be permitted in these hallowed halls, the shit hits the fan? Why is it that in spite of so many costly and time-consuming reforms, official and media inquiries after major failures, time and time again, find smoking gun evidence of responsibility so hard to pin down, and tend instead to find a welter of contradictory accounts of exactly who knew what and when, and alleged meetings or communications for which no proper records turn out to exist? Why is it that the regulation of so many risks, from airport security to childminding among groups of friends, why is that regulation so often rigidly bureaucratic and inflexible, in spite of endless speeches and reports calling for imaginative, light touch, proportionate, risk-based regulation? I could go on. I want to argue that an answer, not necessarily the answer, to all of these questions that I've raised, is that blame avoidance by politicians and appointed government officials often, not always, trumps other concerns in the conduct and structuring of government in general and in the handling of risk more particularly. And I want to argue that that blame avoidance imperative applies as much, if not more, to the behaviour of appointed officials in government as to that of elected politicians, and that it can extend to other actors as well. So what I want to do in the rest of this lecture is to try to explore the logic of blame avoidance as a key factor in shaping how governments deal with risk. So let's turn to the question of what is meant by blame, blame risk, blame games, and blame avoidance. A few definitions here. In dictionary definitions of the word, and I'm not aware of a language that doesn't have a word for blame, though in this learned audience there may be someone who can correct me. In dictionary definitions, blame is conventionally taken to be the act of attributing something that's considered to be bad or wrong to some person or entity. And that means, as this slide shows, that there are two basic elements involved in blame. One is some perceived and avoidable harm or loss, something that someone or some group of people thinks is worse than it could have been if matters had been handled differently, for example, a wrong medical diagnosis. The second element, also shown here, is some attribution of agency or responsibility. Someone or that group of people can identify a person or an organisation whose acts of commission or omission caused that perceived harm or loss, for example, a specific doctor that made that diagnosis. Now, both of these elements, perceived harm and perceived responsibility, can change over time. And time is often crucial to blame, and that's why it appears on this slide. You can blame someone or some entity at one point in time, but not another. If your parents, for example, limited your consumption of sweets or junk food when you were a child, or made you do your violin practice or your maths homework when you wanted to watch TV, you may have blamed them for it at the time, but in later life you may see things differently. Or conversely, if they let you eat whatever you liked and watch TV all night, you may have given them the credit back then, but came to blame them at a later date for your obesity or dental decay or unfulfilled talent or whatever it may be. Blame often turns on exactly when something happened. In politics and bureaucracy, the killer career-ending question is very often, when did you know something or other? Let me come on to blame games. Of course, we can blame ourselves for avoidable harms and losses, and psychologists have got a lot to say about self-blame. My own nearest and dearest are always telling me that I have no one but myself to blame for many of the things that I complain about. But in this lecture, I'm concerned only with blame as a social or a political process, not self-blame. And as a social process, blaming has to involve at least two sets of actors, those who do the blaming and those who are on the receiving end of blame. When those two actors interact, we get what is commonly called a blame game, as two or more players try to pin responsibility onto one another for some event or perceived harm, acting as blamers to avoid being blamees. You don't need to look very far for examples of blame games in that sense. We saw a very interesting example a couple of weeks ago in the United States when the Democrats lost the previously rock-solid Democrat Senate seat of Massachusetts, and the blame game between the senatorial candidate, Martha Coakley, the White House, and the central party apparatus of the Democrat Party was in full swing long before the polls had closed, with many of those actors devoting their attention to blaming one another rather than trying to get in votes. One commentator on a blog site rather pithily observed, twisting the old platitude, "It's not whether you win or lose, it's how you place the blame." Now, blame, of course, is not a simple and homogeneous phenomenon. Who we choose to blame for what is a central marker of our culture and attitudes, as many people have pointed out. Societies often consist of subcultures that are engaged in mutual blaming about the perceived defects of their respective beliefs and preferred ways of life. And the consequences of blame for those who are on the receiving end can vary substantially, from mild social embarrassment to deep shame or extreme legal sanctions. Individuals, too, can vary in how much they care about blame. What might be deep shame for one person might be mild social embarrassment for another. But politicians have good reasons for caring about blame over and above the normal human desire to be thought well of, because blame can affect their chances of re-election. And for the same reason, managers, professionals, and bureaucrats likewise have good reasons to care about blame, insofar as blame can damage their careers. So that's why blame avoidance is an important consideration in the way that government goes about handling risk. Let me turn now to blame avoidance and negativity bias. The term blame avoidance is used to denote both activity and outcomes. The activity of attempting to avoid or reduce blame, and outcomes that involve the absence, deflection, or mitigation of blame. And of course, we have to distinguish between blame avoidance's outcome and blame avoidance's activity, because as a common experience will tell you, and many academic studies will confirm, it is one thing to attempt blame avoidance, another to achieve it. Blame avoidance is an idea that has been in the literature of politics and government for a very long time. For instance, in the early 16th century, Niccolò Machiavelli observed in his book The Prince that, quote, "Princes should give rewards and favours with their own hands, but death and punishment at the hands of others," a theme that's been reworked in many academic articles. Jeremy Bentham, the English philosopher, about 200 years ago in his Constitutional Code, observed in exasperation that in the system of government Britain had back then, no one is responsible for anything that he does. I wonder what he would make of things today. But the term blame avoidance came into the literature of political science in the 1980s, in particular with the work of Kent Weaver of Georgetown University in Washington. Kent Weaver worked on pension and welfare policy, and his point of departure was the observation, puzzling to him, that the politicians that he observed engaged in these policies often seemed to pass up obvious opportunities for claiming credit that he thought could have brought them electoral advantage whenever the chance of credit had to be set against the risk of blame. Now, Weaver linked this observation to the phenomenon of so-called retrospective voting that was coming to attract a lot of attention in political science at that time. That is the tendency of voters to base their electoral choices on the past record of a candidate or a party leader rather than on their promises or plans for the future. And he also linked this blame avoidance imperative to negativity bias. So what do we mean by negativity bias? You may have come across this in earlier lectures in this series, I don't know. Negativity bias is one of various names for the commonly observed cognitive tendency for more attention to be paid to negative than to positive information, and for losses to be valued more highly than gains of an equivalent account. Indeed, losses commonly valued between 2 and 4 times more highly than gains of an equivalent account, according to various experimental studies. In politics, too, it is often said that action is often more prompted by dislike of adversaries or enemies than by positive affection for friends. And dissatisfaction is often said to lead to higher levels of political activity, such as turnout or switching votes among parties, than corresponding levels of satisfaction. Elected politicians often turn out to get less credit from the voters for their successes than the blame they get for their failures. Several studies have brought out this phenomenon. Just to pick out a couple of examples, some years ago, Olivier Borras, making a study of how French municipalities had handled the issue of changing France's traditional practice, hope you haven't had your dinner, of spreading sewage sludge on the fields as agricultural fertilizer, he found that those municipalities that performed extremely badly in this task did tend to suffer, the incumbents suffered at the polls, but those that did extremely well had no corresponding advantage. They were not rewarded by the voters. And a study by Oliver James and Peter John of English local authorities a few years ago came to exactly the same conclusion about how incumbents fared relative to performance in English local authorities. Very poor levels of performance tended to attract punishment from the voters, but excellent levels of performance were not similarly rewarded. We also often find that media treatment of public policy developments often focus on the negatives rather than on the positives. An example that I think may be familiar to you is what happened to press reactions to Tony Blair's well-known target systems for health and education. If we take what happened to waiting times, in this case for angioplasty and elective heart surgery, and if we believe those official figures, we see an astonishing decline in wait times relative to the targets set. Similarly, if we look at what happened to achievements of school pupils at age 11, key stage 2, on maths and literacy, we see a remarkable climb on those official figures from the levels of the late 1990s. How did the press react? Here's a study that I did with Ruth Dixon in Oxford last year, where we coded the stories in a series of British newspapers, looking at the red articles, those that we coded negative, and the green ones, those we coded positive. And as you can see, the press reaction was overwhelmingly and increasingly negative. The press focused on the fiddles and the failures. Politicians and public managers are often exasperated by negativity bias in news media. And some of the biggest miscalculations of even seasoned and experienced politicians can arise from a failure to anticipate either the existence or the effect, the extent of negativity effects, therefore underestimating their blame risk. A well-known example to you will be the ending of Margaret Thatcher's reign as British Prime Minister after she failed to calculate that the losers from her 1989 poll tax would prove to be far more voluble and active than the gainers, even though the latter were more numerous than the former. Similarly, Jacques Chirac's long career in French politics never recovered after he failed to calculate that a referendum in 2005 on the new European constitution would act as a catalyst for everyone in France who was discontented with his rule, rather than a grateful endorsement of a bold new vision of European unity. Negativity bias is often at the heart of bureaucratic behaviour too, and for the same kinds of reasons, because media, legislative committees, and indeed political and bureaucratic masters tend to pay more attention to their failures than to their successes. So risk aversion, or as I would call it, blame avoidance, has commonly been noted as an observable trait in bureaucratic behaviour. So negativity bias gives us one reason for why blame avoidance makes sense as a preoccupation for politicians and bureaucrats, and why it makes sense for blame avoidance to trump credit claiming when those two things come into conflict. At the time when Kent Weaver, who coined this phrase, blame avoidance, was originally writing, similar themes were emerging from writing about social psychology and social choice theory. And in the 20-odd years or so since Weaver originally wrote, the blame avoidance perspective has been developing in political science in several ways. It's come about, it's been developed by people working in the field of welfare policy, exploring how elected politicians are able to make welfare state cutbacks while minimising the risk of electoral punishment from voters. For example, work on Swedish welfare state cutbacks in the 1990s, observing how politicians in that state worked on ways of making cuts in welfare in such a way as to make the minimum perceived harm such that the labour unions found it difficult to find a clear-cut issue to march against on May Day demonstrations. We've also seen attempts to go beyond Weaver's original insights by work in experimental studies, quantitative studies, looking at how politicians deal with blame over time. If I have time, I will show you this one. This is a study that I did for the Centre for the Analysis of Risk and Regulation in the LSE, where what we did was to look at two fiascos over school leaving exam marks, and the top one relates to the Scottish Hires failure of 2000, and the bottom one refers to the English A-level fiasco of 2002. And what we did was to code the level of blame coming from the media every day, and that's what you see in those columns, and we were then able to look at what the responsible office holders did on each one of those days when they were dealing with blame coming from the media. And then that gives you the ability to look at what difference does it make what they say to deal with blame and what happens in the following day. We found that in England, it did make some difference what the politicians said as to what the following day's blame would be. In Scotland, nothing they could say could escape them from blame. Now, what I want to turn to now is the roads to blame avoidance. And having defined blame risk and explored the idea of blame avoidance and what lies behind it, I want to turn to forms that blame avoidance takes. If we go back to what I described earlier as the basic elements of blame, namely the perception of avoidable loss or harm and the perception of agency or responsibility, then it follows that strategies for avoiding blame must logically work on either or both of those two elements, either by reducing perceptions of harm or by reducing perceptions of agency, or both. And given that time is a key element in blaming as well, we could perhaps distinguish between anticipative approaches to blame avoidance, seeking to stop blame before it starts, for instance, by the well-known tactic of pre-buttle, or getting your retaliation in first, from those that are reactive, operating after blame has got started, like a fire crew going to put out fires. So logically, we could imagine a 2x2 table of these kinds of possibilities. But if we turn from these logical possibilities to looking more inductively at the literature on the subject, the specific strategies for blame avoidance that tend to be most discussed in the literature are what in previous work I've termed presentational strategies, agency strategies, and policy strategies. Presentational strategies focus on changing or shaping perceptions, often of harm, but sometimes of responsibility too. Presentational strategies focus on framing, rhetorical argument, and spin doctoring activity. They can be encapsulated in the saying that the best way to deal with nuclear waste is to hire a PR company. Agency strategies focus on organisational design, those things that Christopher Pollitt noticed that prime ministers and their senior official advisers spent so much time on. The allocation of office holders to portfolios. And those strategies deal with the perceived responsibility element of blame. The most commonly discussed form of agency strategy, and there's a substantial literature on it, is delegation. And that is frequently used to deal with blame risk. For instance, it is notable that the BSE fiasco, which caused so much political trouble for British government in the 1990s, and the trouble over release of foreign prisoners on their release from prison into the community, which caused trouble for the Labour government in the 2000s, indeed brought down a Home Secretary. Both of those fiascos were both followed by radical delegation of those toxic policy responsibilities to arm's length agencies. Policy or operational strategies focus on the process of policy and the standard operating routines that organisations follow, rather than with distribution of responsibility in an organisational structure, again, mainly to deal with the responsibility element of blame. Perhaps the classic example of this sort of approach is the much-discussed practice of so-called defensive medicine, a term that was originally coined in the United States in the late 1960s to denote the practice of medicine in a manner primarily designed to avoid the risk of malpractice suits, by a mixture of what is called assurance and avoidance behaviour. Avoidance behaviour denotes avoidance of high-risk patients, such as medical malpractice lawyers or their families, while assurance behaviour denotes the pursuit of every possible diagnostic or therapeutic option or the following of standard protocols in every case to reduce the risk of allegations of negligence. And we find analogous practices in many other public services as well. People speak about defensive social work. At a seminar at LSE 3 years ago, I even heard the term defensive education coined. I could say more about these approaches, but there's just two things that I want to say at this point. The first is that if we put these approaches that you can derive from the literature together with the typology of logical possibilities that I presented earlier, I would argue that what I called the agency and policy strategies for blame avoidance can only really work if they are anticipative, if they work before the fact. But presentational strategies can be used both anticipatively and reactively. They can be used anticipatively, for example, to lower expectations or to deny responsibility in advance, as when police chiefs tell us that major terrorist incidents are inevitable or that it's impossible for the police to deal with crime because of the breakdown of social discipline and family structures. But they can also be used reactively when blame has started, a process that I think is well captured by Paul Flynn's brilliant observation in the context of New Labour rule in Wales in the late 1990s that, quote, only the future is certain, the past is always changing. That all-purpose nature of presentational strategies, I think, tell us why government leaders and top politicians tend to spend so much time on them. The other point that I want to make here is that each of these types of blame avoidance can itself take multiple forms. For instance, in the case of presentational strategies, we can distinguish between the sort of spin or rhetorical activity that is designed to win arguments over blame, to persuade people that either agency or responsibility, that agency or harm is less than might be thought by making plausible arguments or offering justifications. And we can distinguish those that operate in other ways. Other ways that presentational strategies can work are through non-engagement, simply not responding when accusations or blames is flying around, the no-comment strategy or the empty chair approach, the changing the subject approach, finding good days to bury bad news, such as public holidays or major sporting events. When I worked in Australia, the announcement of pay increases for politicians tended to come out on New Year's Day or sometimes Christmas Eve, or by drawing a line approaches, or what some have called sorry democracy tactics, in which leaders concede that mistakes have been made, often in that so-called past exonerative tense, which is said to date back at least to the mid-19th century, but then hastily seek to draw a line under whatever it was and move on without detailed debate. In the case of agency strategies, we can also find numerous types. For example, we can distinguish between simple delegation, in which responsibilities are passed from one organisation or actor to another in a clear-cut way, from other ways of shaping perceptions of responsibility. Those other ways, other than clear-cut delegation, include defensive reorganisation, management or ministerial merry-go-rounds, something that was much criticised in the report of the Better Government Initiative that came out a couple of weeks ago, has been criticised by many other similar reports in the past and very likely will in the future. The merry-go-round approach in which any current incumbent of any position can deny responsibility for what happened under the old structure or the old management. Other forms of agency strategies can include complex partnership arrangements, such as we see over Olympic Games and other events of that type, in which it's hard to attribute responsibility among a group of organisations who can blame one another when things go wrong. Complex intergovernmental relations will do, and complex intergovernmental arrangements will do the same kind of thing. In the case of policy strategies for blame avoidance, we can distinguish, as I indicated earlier, with the example of defensive medicine, between assurance strategies, often involving heavy reliance on rules or protocols, and avoidance strategies that involve decisions not to provide certain services which may attract blame, such as advice. Other categories of policy strategy that can be observed are those cases in which decisions are made by groups rather than individuals to spread blame, and the contrary case where blame is individualised by disclaimers or policies that put all the onus of responsibility onto individual users or operators. Now, of course, at the margin, these three approaches merge into one another. For example, where organisation is so plastic that you can't really distinguish between agency strategies and presentational strategies. But the two points that I want to leave you with at this stage are, first, that there are several roads to blame avoidance in government and politics, not just one. And second, that once you start thinking along the lines that I've been trying to sketch out this evening, you can identify a logic, an architectonic in that sense, of how to design policy, how to design operating routines, how to structure organisations, how to handle information, that often runs clean counter to orthodox precepts about good organisation and policy in government that assume away blame risk and assume away negativity bias. And this point was borne in on me very sharply 10 years or so when I was conducting a study of 9 so-called risk regulation regimes with Henry Rothstein, who's here in the audience tonight, and Robert Baldwin, and realised that the apparently dysfunctional nature of some of these regimes, in which responsibility was often diffuse, defensiveness in many cases reigned, despite all the rhetoric of clear-cut accountability and risk-based proportionality, I realised that those regimes could make perfect sense if we took blame avoidance as the underlying logic of design. And I think that point can be made more broadly about the organisation and operation of government and public services. Now I want to move from the descriptive or stamp-collecting account that I've been giving you so far of how blame risk can be handled in government and what that means for the way government works, to more normative, more what-to-do reflections. Now, like social conflict, blame avoidance and blame games, mutual blaming amongst individuals and organisations trying to disclaim responsibility for perceived loss or harm, these things generally get a bad press. They're a favourite target of media attacks, of satirical jokes, even of more academic work, the tone of which is very commonly to frown upon blame games and blame avoidance as dysfunctional, decidedly unheroic, and a rather unsavoury aspect of politics and bureaucracy that the world would be better off without. No self-respecting superhero of popular culture would dream of concerning her or himself with blame avoidance. blame cultures tend to be castigated by politicians, commentators, and public managers as something we need to get away from into some better blame-free world. If you look on the internet for jokes about blame and blame avoidance, you find they almost invariably focus on the negative aspects of blame, and social conversations on the subject, at least the ones that I'm involved in, very often take the same tone. But just as Louis Kozer many years ago pointed out to that social conflict could have positive functions, I would like to close this lecture by challenging this often implicit or semi-explicit view by trying to offer a slightly more nuanced perspective and generally putting in a bit of a good word for blame as a phenomenon, for blame games, and even for some, at least, kinds of blame avoidance activity in the handling of risk. So I'd like to argue that blame and the desire to avoid blame can have positive social and political effects. It can lead individuals to follow rules and conventions and observe social restraints that they would not otherwise do. A so-called blame culture may have its disadvantages, but if we imagine the opposite, a no-blame culture, we can see that that is far from problem-free too. It would be a world in which there are fewer incentives to take care about how we behave, what we say to whom, how we conduct our personal lives, and what we do at work. A world in which those who rule us never had to fear any blame would not necessarily be a better governed world than one in which they could never think about anything else. And if you think that it's a jungle out there on the roads at present, if you come here on your car or on your bike, just imagine what it would be like if no blame was ever attached to driving errors or accidents. And I think it should be said, too, that even blame games, in the sense of mutual blaming among two or more potential blamees, can have positive effects, too, even though, if anything, they get a worse press than blame cultures. That's because blame games, in that sense, can perform a social discovery function about the attribution of responsibility for avoidable harms in complex institutional settings that are hard to achieve in any other way. Now, we wouldn't need blame games for that purpose either if we could somehow write down in advance exactly who was going to be responsible for what in every circumstance that could possibly arise, so-called contingent contracting, as economists call it, or if we could rely on professionals, scientists, and technocrats to evaluate just where blame should lie. But there are always going to be limits to the extent to which we can do that. There are going to be limits to the contingent contracting, write down everything in advance approach, try running your own family that way. And there are also limits to which we can leave evaluation of blame to professionals and technocrats. Expert evaluation is very often limited by lack of available data or by disagreement among the scientists, experts, or professionals themselves. And it's because we can't rely on those approaches to settle questions of blame that we need blame games. Mutual blaming, however undignified and messy the process may be in the glare of media attention, may have a valuable discovery function to play over the attribution of responsibility and maybe perception of harm as well. Finally, blame avoidance behaviour is not necessarily all bad either. Of course, there are some obvious dysfunctions that can follow from preoccupations with blame avoidance, where blame risks shape the way that every other kind of risk is handled. It can lead to attempts to shift the burden of responsibility for adverse outcomes from those who are best placed to handle the risk to those who are least prepared to do so. And it can in some cases lead to heightened risk to individuals and greater cost to society as a whole, something that has been much stressed by critics of defensive medicine, who point out that the mixture of assurance and avoidance behaviour that it involves both greatly increases the overall costs of healthcare, whether those costs are met from general taxation or from insurance charges, and can expose individuals to greater health risks as a result from the damage that over-testing can do, for example, when X-rays or CT scans are used. And when organisations select much of their staff not for any positive talents, but for their inability to challenge their bosses and their suitability to act as blame fodder when things go wrong on the so-called negative selection principle, which was said to have been built into the institutional landscape of the former Soviet Union, obviously deeply dysfunctional organisational can result. But does all blame avoidance have this kind of obviously dysfunctional effects? I want to suggest that it does not. And that is why I've called this final section the wrong sort of blame avoidance. And as the older listeners in the room will perhaps know, that phrase recalls a famous excuse given by the then nationalised rail operator British Rail in 1991 to explain why so many of its trains ground to a halt in relatively light snowfall in the south of England, the explanation being that it was the wrong sort of snow. And I want to argue that just as there was good snow and bad snow for those rather unmedia-savvy railway engineers, we ought to be trying to distinguish between good blame avoidance and bad blame avoidance. So I want to argue in conclusion on the wrong kind of snow principle that not all blame avoidance activity is negative in its effects on governance or risk management. And I want to conclude then on an Aristotelian note, I think it would be, by suggesting that each of the types of blame avoidance strategy that I referred to earlier, namely presentational strategies, agency strategies and policy strategies, can have variants that are positive or negative when we judge them against three criteria for good governance, namely whether they sharpen or blunt policy debate, whether they focus or diffuse accountability, and whether they increase or decrease transparency. And if we use that sort of criterion, it would follow that those presentational strategies that are designed to engage in argument by offering persuasive excuses or justifications for why something was done or not done can be considered positive against that first criterion, while those presentational strategies that are designed to evade arguments by changing the subject or killing debate in some way are negative. Similarly, those agency strategies that involve clear-cut delegation of authority can be considered positive against the second criterion, that is, they focus accountability, while those strategies that are concerned with muddying the waters of perceived responsibility, the defensive reorganisation, the multi-organisational arrangements that leave responsibility vague, would count as negative. And those policy strategies that involve avoidance behaviour, for example, in decisions not to avoid, not to provide service that may attract blame, and some aspects of assurance behaviour too, such as rule following, might be considered positive against the transparency criterion, while policy strategies such as herding in decision-making might be considered negative. So to conclude, and returning to the general theme of government and the management of risk that you asked me to reflect upon this evening, my argument has been twofold. First, that to understand how government manages risk, it's important to pay attention to the risk that ordinarily matters most in government and bureaucracy, namely the risk of blame. And secondly, that blame games and blame avoidance, though they almost invariably get a bad press, are not all bad, and that in some cases at least they can have positive effects on some conventional criteria for good governance. The problem then becomes, how can we tell good from bad blame avoidance, and how can we encourage the good kinds and discourage the bad forms that undermine the quality of government? After 50 minutes, I will not weary you by trying to offer a lengthy answer to that question, beyond observing that while there may be some scope for tackling that issue by formal or legal measures, or even by what some lawyers call soft law, it is mostly to politics with a small p as well as a large p, that is social processes of naming, shaming and claiming, that we need to look to in controlling this phenomenon. I think there are limits to which we can distinguish the wrong sorts of, discourage the wrong sorts of blame avoidance and encourage the right sorts by bureaucratic and technocratic means. And if there is a fix, I think the fix must mainly be a political and democratic fix. Thank you.
I must say, for those of you who were here last week, I thought there were some fascinating echoes of the last week's discussion of the neurological manifestations of the exercise of free will, and this week's discussion of the social attribution of manifestations of free will. But it leaves me wondering, what is the social evolutionary origins of negativity bias? It almost makes you feel sorry for politicians. It almost makes you feel that there's a purpose in having spin doctors. And then these fascinating things: pre-buttle, cosmetic delegation, assurance and avoidance. You know, the things they teach to aspiring politicians in Oxford these days. but it has been a fascinating analysis. The dynamics of the way that blame sloshes around the system, because clearly it's very important that the buck stops somewhere. And this is an analysis which has, I think, profound implications for notions of accountability in a democracy. Professor Hood, thank you very much.